The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast. But the QA is the important part. SGG question and answer. We like to make this an interactive conversation about the top tech news stories that are hitting the web. It's why I like to hold my show on a Monday, sort out our feels, maybe some news broke over the weekend. We've got some pretty big politics news to get through this week, but I'm still going to try and keep the news block a little bit more efficient. I don't know. I mean, like, so people tell me in the chat right now, I feel like the last couple of weeks I've been on a pretty good flow, kind of squishing all of our links just a little bit, still trying to point out stories I think we should keep track of, but spending a little bit more time at the end of the podcast for our gadget block and getting to talk about some really cool, fun toys, like the couple weeks that I've spent with the Xperia 1 Mark IV before I literally put it in a box today to send it back to Sony. It's like I'm purposely stretching this just through this morning so I can hold up the One Mark IV as a prop on the video version of the podcast. I'm already seeing an amazing group of folks here in the live chat. My voice is already getting shaky. That's a little twitchy already. I'm seeing Otaku, Gabaletta, My Tech Review, JMX Warrior, Farhan, Gary the Fireman. What's up, Gary? He's saying, hey, geeks. Dustadori, Dave Burns, Ted Talks Tech, Twin Folk Tech, Ben Pai So Kawaii, Grounded Tech Dan, Gormlord, Fat Produce, everyone say, hey, Andrew. Good morning, Andrew. I mean, this is a good crew. I'm loving this. This is going to be awesome. Farhan, 8893. If the 5 Mark IV is not coming, then the 1 Mark IV is definitely in my wish list. Aditya Anil saying, what up, Gary? How have you been? Love to see Gary the Fireman in the chat. Otaku, don't say tech news. Linus will show up and sue us. I don't think you can like trademark tech news. I feel like I've been producing tech news for a while. I think we're safe. But folks, Oh, everyone say Gary the Fireman. Huge congratulations. Gary writes, my daughter got married last weekend. It's been a crazy few months. Congratulations. I'm so excited to hear that. And happy well wishes to both families as you've made your family larger. I hope everything went well during the ceremony and reception. That's amazing. So congratulations. That's truly awesome. So here, let me get this out of the way there. So, Gary obviously had a great weekend, but I hope everyone else had a lovely weekend too. I had to post on the Patreon. I did a sort of a little BTS production diary entry. I've been burning the candle at both ends, and there's been some really cool stuff coming out. Like these are videos and projects and write-ups and collaborations that I'm really excited to be working on. But man, I mean, I think you could see it if you caught last Thursday's Best of Our Week, where TK and I just look like we're whooped. We just look tired. And don't get me wrong, I'm old, so I always look kind of tired, but I looked tired for my age. So, starting this week, this is the Monday, I'm excited to hit the ground running. We've got a great crew of people to jump in and chat with. We've got a lot of news to get through. I feel like this is going to be a really, really, a really strong week. I've got some really exciting stuff coming out. So I don't want to kind of burn too much time here. We do have some housekeeping, some links to talk about. Some of these projects that are, like, I've been sitting on some of this stuff for a while. Like, it's been killing me not being able to tell people everything I want to tell them about the Xperia, about the One More earbuds, which are now not sitting right in front of me. Why don't we jump through some housekeeping? I haven't done an over-under in a while. It's 9:04 in the a.m. I think I can finish before 9:14. I think I can finish some Gadget Guy housekeeping in 10 minutes or less. So let's get to it. Here, let me get this back. We're going to screen share now. And here's a better picture. This is the One More Evo review, true wireless earbuds with ANC. They're real good. Really excited to spend some time with One More. They're one of my favorite true wireless and Bluetooth audio companies. I've been using their neckband like crazy for years now. And the Evo are a nice continuation of the One More mission. So there's a full review on true wireless with ANC, their dual driver earbuds, and now they support LDAC. This is a nice premium tier audio listening experience. JMX Warrior saying 13 minutes. I'm already a quarter of the way done. Obviously, we're going to be talking about this in the gadget block. I'm not going to waste too much time here. I got my first look video out on the Sony Xperia 1 Mark IV. The only thing I'm going to say here in the housekeeping is anyone who's putting out a review on the Xperia 1 Mark IV is basically lying to you. This is not retail hardware or retail software. So I feel like that is a horrifically disingenuous way to talk about a Sony, saying like, well, this is what it is, and now I know what a Sony is, and that's all you need to know, when several features and several major selling points of the phone are not ready. like there are apps that just aren't even installed yet that will be on the retail units. So, while I review other reviewers, I'm just saying a first look at a prototype phone, totally appropriate. And then a major, this one was huge for me. I do not do a lot of sponsored videos or collaborations on my channel. I don't even run a lot of ads. So this one is a big deal for two reasons. I'm starting a new series. I'm hoping to do about a video a month, but I really want to cobble together good resources and some good talking points on technology that can help us in emergencies and disasters. So this series, I'm waffling between disaster prep tech and emergency tech prep, but it's probably going to be named one of those. When I reached out to a couple companies to see if they would be interested in participating, Anker stepped up, and they sent over their new 757 powerhouse. This is a 45-pound portable battery generator. It can run kitchen appliances, depending on your full-sized refrigerator, it might be able to kick on your full-size refrigerator. It's 1,229 watt-hour battery, capable of 1,500 watt total output. This thing is a monster. And so the folks at Anchor not only liked the idea of starting off a conversation about sort of emergency tech, they sponsored the very first episode of it. So I have to throw a huge shout out to Anchor, this podcast, not sponsored by Anchor, but this video, sponsored by Anchor. It was an amazing way to start a new series and to kick off a collaboration while talking about something that legit, I've never used anything like it. It legit fulfills a phenomenal role in sort of an outdoorsy lifestyle, tailgating, camping, glamping. If you're into RV lifestyle, you're just sort of like van life, that kind of a thing. This is the power station that you might want to look at. So, I was so tickled to get to share that with everybody. From Farhan, if last March's pajama podcast stream happens again, that Anchor powerhouse can really be handy. That's kind of the point. Again, I'm not quite done with housekeeping. It's 9:08. I'm not quite done with housekeeping, but 2 days after I finished sort of the reference edit for that video and I sent it off to Anchor, because it's a sponsored video. They've got to weigh in and they've got to give notes and stuff. They didn't change anything. They actually just asked for different text on screen. They were like, hey, the rest of what you've edited sounds great. Because I'm very good at what I do. So I sent it over to them. 2 days later, we go through a day of some of the worst rolling blackouts we've ever had here in Southern California. So again, like that March pajama podcast was bad. I think we were without power for almost 5 hours, off and on, like without any kind of reliable power for almost 5 hours. Except in our house, where everything we had was plugged in to the 757, and it kept my wife's laptop going. It kept me writing on another laptop. We had, I have like this little emergency crank radio just in case. We had that plugged in, charged up. We had a flashlight just in case anything. Like, we didn't get power into nighttime. The 757 really did fulfill that role. And then just as a joke, I was like, I'm going to brew some coffee. Yeah, it was like, the coffee brewer we use can only be operated for about an hour straight. Like, it pulls a ridiculous amount of power to heat those coils. But the 757 knocked out a delicious pot of coffee for us. You know, again, it was like creature comforts. For a while, we plugged in one of the small little fans just so that Marie could have some airflow by her desk. I mean, it literally did the gig. So now I'm looking for some solar panels. We need to find a portable refrigerator for our medications. It's awesome. And again, in every way that like a gas-powered backup generator wouldn't have been able to run indoors. We don't have a place to keep it outside. Would have been way too loud. This was legit. To think that once I get some solar panels for this thing, it could just keep running out in the field kind of indefinitely is sort of awesome. So that video, I'm really proud of how that video came out. But then on top of that, I'm looking for other suggestions and other topics that we can join this conversation. Obviously, solar is going to be a major part of this chat. I want to talk about portable refrigerators, camping refrigerators, coolers, things that can kind of help keep medications cold. A lot of us are on medications that need to be refrigerated. I want to talk about communications equipment. Someone brought up FM radios. Like, when was the last time you invested in a good backup FM radio? When there's an emergency, that's probably one of the ways that we'll get good information out to people if our communications network goes down. So I'm excited. This is going to be a really fun series where I feel like we need to talk more about using this stuff and where we can use it rather than just here are all the specs and it's too expensive. You should buy a Apple. So the other major video that went up, speaking of videos that try and balance consumer expectations, try and save you a little cash. The guys at Slick Deals, our timing was spot on. We published a video called, Is 4K Netflix Worth $20 a Month? This was kind of a big deal video for us because we shot this before a lot of the major news at Netflix went down and before like some of their major subscriber loss. And we weren't really planning on putting this out until I think the beginning of June. And so then everything went down. We were like, oh, we got to scramble. We've got this video in the can now. And I'm just really glad that my sort of assessment, like the conclusion of this video fits the narrative that we're talking about with Netflix as a subscription service today. But we wrote that before all of that major stuff went down. So again, I'm really glad it wasn't just me like, yeah, I'll just chill for Netflix and this is what I think about it. And then like the sky is falling and then I'd have to change my tune. No. We were on the pulse. So that's going to kind of do it for housekeeping right now. Obviously, there's going to be some other content going out on reviews.org. Make sure you're tuning in Thursdays as TK and I host the best of our week. We have a weekly just kind of catch up podcast where we're just two buddies and we're talking about what we liked over the last week. And everything else that we're going to be talking about today, housekeeping, all of the news, the subreddit, all of the links, you'll be able to find that on this week's show notes on somegadgetguy.com. So, yes, why don't we knock out news? 9:13! Housekeeping. 9 minutes. I love it. Oh, McCorkorin 3, the LG G8X still has FM radio. Maybe newer ones don't. I'm not sure. I'm playing with a couple phones. Like, a lot of the mid-ranger phones I'm playing with definitely still have FM radio. I'm trying to think of any of the newer ones. Part of the issue is, I wonder if you can't do FM radio on premium tier phones that don't have a pass-through DAC. So, my OnePlus 10 Pro has a headphone DAC, there's just no headphone port. So if you have a USB dongle or a pass-through dongle, you can get a signal out. So I wonder if there's an issue. Like if you have only the ability to pass USB audio to a USB DAC, maybe it can't talk to the phone internally to use your headphones as an antenna for an FM radio. I'm going to need to talk to an engineer about that. I wonder if that is a limitation, but it's still one of my all-time favorite scenes in any horror film. If you watch the film Hashtag Alive, it's a South Korean zombie film. People are all holed up in their apartments. Zombies are running nuts. The main character gets an alert saying, hey, there are emergency notices that are going up over FM radio. You can use these devices. All he has to do is plug in some headphones, and he can't. He empties out this box of like gear that he has, and he has nothing but Bluetooth headphones. So he can't get the FM radio alerts on his phone. And again, as the headphone nerd that I am, I was just so tickled that they depicted that accurately. I love it. So yeah, any phone that has an FM radio built in, you need to use the headphone cable as your antenna. So I don't know if anyone understands that radio protocol better than I do. Let me know if there's anyone who's more knowledgeable on that topic than I am. Yeah, Twin Folk Tech. That part is hilarious. Such a fun movie. There's just a really beautiful sort of cinema renaissance happening in South Korea, especially for horror films. I'd say since The Host. I just so enjoy their take on modern horror tropes. So I'm going to kind of shift here. Why don't we knock out some news? Let's get through this because I really want to spend some time, and especially for questions, people who want to talk about the Xperia. I still have every other phone on my desk. There's two phones I can't talk about that you don't know what I have, so that's fine. But if you want to ask me like random Surface Duo questions, the most recent Surface Duo, I know I've been saying this for a while, and I still haven't gotten a video out on it. There was yet another Duo 1 and Duo 2 update. This thing is running, it's one of the best tablets ever made now. I mean, it really is genuinely great. So, I'm going to get this out of the way here. Gormlord, Train to Busan.
Chef's kiss. Just incredible. And there's nothing like fancy or new or disruptive about Train to Busan. It's just a really well-constructed zombie film, hits all of the zombie tropes, claustrophobia, movement, action, peril. It's gorgeous. I mean, it's just genuinely a phenomenal movie. So let's jump in. First up, we like I said, we've got a lot of politics news to cover. This is one that we need to keep an eye on, in my opinion, because some of these infrastructure deals will throw a lot of money around. I feel this is where we need to be active in writing our local, our state elected officials to make sure that this money is being appropriately doled out to the services and to the infrastructure that we care about. I think all too often we see big spending bill, big infrastructure bill, and then a lot of that money just sort of gets hoovered up by a couple of interest groups, and then real change never really makes it down to people on the ground level. This is directly from the U.S. Department of Commerce. Biden-Harris administration launches $45 billion Internet for All initiative to bring affordable, reliable, high-speed internet to everyone in America. Today, U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo will visit Durham, North Carolina, to announce the launch of the Biden-Harris administration's Internet for All initiative, which will invest $45 billion to provide affordable, reliable, high-speed internet for everyone in America by the end of the decade. The initiative will be administered and implemented by the U.S. Department of Commerce's National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the NTIA. So this is a very broad set of plans and initiatives. This isn't just, we're going to spend $45 billion and plug a modem into everyone's home. There's infrastructure that needs to be considered. There are going to be pilot programs for getting better equipment into consumers' hands, into schools, into libraries. Some of the recent FCC emergency initiatives are getting kind of rolled into similar programs here. There are going to be different state funds that states can take advantage of. Each participating state is guaranteed a minimum $100 million allocation with additional funding determinations made based on the forthcoming coverage maps from the FCC. So when we start talking about this type of broad infrastructure and all of the moving parts, there's so many things happening. So many different municipalities and cities and states and legalities and local state laws and federal initiatives. When we start looking at how all of this is sort of doled out, one of the things that's going to matter is accurate data. Again, what we remember from the Ajit Pai years at the FCC is we didn't have a good idea of what the true impact or what the true numbers were for families who lacked access to broadband. Because we have one tier, literally people who cannot get broadband. Even by the mediocre and pitiful definition of high speed today, which is like, I think it's 25 up, 3 down. All right, 25 down, 3 up, or 5 up. Something like should not be difficult. We don't know how many people literally can't get it. Of the people who have access to broadband, we don't know how many of them truly can't afford it. And so from there, then we've got sort of a sliding scale of internet service providers that are advertising high speed but can't really deliver it. And at the same time, we also need to redefine high speed broadband, because 25 down really isn't high speed in the 21st century. All of those moving parts. However, we're going to set money aside. And then we also need to see, when public funds are being used for infrastructure, what does that mean for all of the private corporations that have already received fees and tax breaks and zoning deals and sweetheart deals, literally gotten money from the federal government to roll out these programs and really haven't delivered? Again, remember, there was a ton of money dumped into the coffers of ISPs during the Trump administration with almost no accountability. Like, they weren't really responsible for doing anything with that cash. So we definitely need to keep an eye on this. $45 billion over 10 years is kind of too much to just let evaporate. So where I would normally say, like, oh, hey, you know, tweet my show out and share my videos and stuff, maybe consider taking a minute you know, a couple minutes out of your day and write your senator. Yes, Dave Burns, I'm expecting a lot of stock buybacks when this money starts pouring into ISPs. Because again, one of those things that's going to happen, we've seen those initiatives and they can really help people. So I'm not really trying to besmirch federal funds going to help citizens, but we're subsidizing the profits of those major telecoms by sort of just dumping money unregulated into this industry. Yeah, it's galling when it's like, you know, oh, well, we're going to offer this low-cost plan. Okay, great. So the person who's really using that broadband connection is underserved. They're probably really not getting broadband speeds. They likely don't have devices that can fully utilize modern-day internet connections, but the ISP is going to charge them less. Great. Okay, I am wholly in favor of that. But then at the same time, they then send a bill to the federal government or to the state government, depending on the relationship locally there. And then taxpayers are subsidizing that cost. So if taxpayer funds ever go into private corporation coffers, I feel they need to be operating under the strictest scrutiny. I think we get a say. When my tax dollars go to subsidizing that kind of kind of connection, I have a vote in how that should go down. That's my money, pennies of it, but it's my money. So, or for example, it's like even more galling, like Starlink got all that positive buzz on sending modems to the Ukraine. That's great. What a great story. Out of the goodness of their hearts, Elon Musk, SpaceX, and Starlink, keeping people connected in the Ukraine, good data, satellite communications, they sent the bill to the federal government. So they got billions of dollars to donate that telecom equipment to the Ukraine. That's not a feel-good story. That's just sales. We sold so many modems to the USA, and then the USA sent them to Ukraine. So let's scrutinize these plans a lot. This isn't a, you know, oh, Biden good, Trump bad. I feel like the Biden administration has been, or the NTIA, I should say. I still want to see the breakdown on how those funds are really going to be doled out. I really want to see how those funds are going to be delivered. Because, and the reason why I want to come down hard on the Biden administration is because we didn't see any oversight during the Trump administration. Unfortunately, oversight can only happen when Democrats are in office. So I guess that's how we'll do it. But it needs to be pretty brutal, because this is an allocation of funds that will last through the next two presidential administrations. That's a long time. Moving on. Oh, yeah, Dave Burns. I caught myself saying that just before someone rips your head off. It's Ukraine, not the Ukraine. It's a sovereign state and not a region. I felt myself saying it twice and then tried to catch it that third time. So very well pointed out. Thank you for correcting me on that one. Let me get this out of the way, right? Purposely Gaming. Elon Musk, so generous, right? Right. Yeah, I know. Yeah, Andrew, again, even before the Clinton administration, Andrew writes, during the Clinton era, they had the fiber spending bills that ended up going into the pockets of ISPs and never made it to customers. We've paid for fiber to home several times over, and we've come up with so many jumping through hoops, technicalities, shades of gray, legal wrangling to justify why we still haven't delivered it. It's going to be too expensive, except we've already put the money to it several times over. We should have it now. The only future improvements that we can eke out of our telecommunications network is to go fiber to home. That's it. We talked last week. We're going through yet another permutation of cable broadband and twisted copper that we're going to squeeze the last ounces of broadband capability out of copper, and it's still not going to hit fiber. We need to go fiber. And it's silly anymore pretending like this is even a debate. Dave Burns, it was four times over in 2014. Yeah, I believe it. Totally believe it. All right, next story up. This is a continuation. We've been keeping an eye on this. I feel Apple's responses to sort of the unintended and some of the scary tracking that can happen with AirTags have been insufficient. Obviously, a number of organizations and agencies around the country feel likewise, and now we're seeing a bill going up in Ohio which would outlaw secret electronic tracking with devices like Apple AirTags after 3 News advocates for legislation. So this is coming out of WKYC Studios in Ohio, in Columbus, Ohio. They did an expose on AirTags and how AirTags can be used by stalkers to track people without their knowing, how easy this process is, and they made enough of a ripple that the state legislature is now looking at a bill specifically targeting the people who would engage in this behavior. So these are the types of things. Like when I say, take a minute out of your day and write a local lawmaker, these are the types of things that we can initiate on the ground. We can put support towards right to repair. We can put support towards, you know, a bill sort of reining in the digital use or the unintended use of things like AirTags. Is this going to immediately change the technology? No. But if it puts up enough of a perception that it harms the product, well, guess what? Apple makes less money and they're going to have an incentive to change, fix, or refine how AirTags operate. As far as I'm concerned, AirTags will not be a consumer-facing safe product until Apple works with the Bluetooth special interests group to come up with a special trigger for location data sharing devices. The current responses that Apple have put out, insufficient. Don't work for older iPhone users, don't work for Android users, not sufficient. This is a product that can be extremely dangerous for people by its core design. That needs to be addressed. And I feel like Apple, again, trying to buck the trend of breaking standards so that their users have their own proprietary solutions, this doesn't work for something like the AirTags. It's annoying when you can't send a file to an iPhone from an Android phone and that only iPhones can use AirDrop. It's annoying when you can't use an Android phone on a Mac because they broke the USB protocol so that that can't work. It's annoying when your text messages are a different color because Apple profits directly off of kids' cyberbullying. But AirTags, this is already proven to be a privacy and location nightmare product. And until Apple, to its core, fundamentally changes how the AirTag notifies other people around it to its existence, then I think it's dangerous. So this is where we start. We start with laws targeting specific types of behavior, specific types of usage, making sure that there's a direct, on the books, legal penalty to operating this way. I know Otaku. Otaku writes, Apple, work with others? Compromise? Juan, you crack me up. And McCorkran, this is totally true too. So again, I need to point this out. I'm not picking on you, McCorkran here. He writes, of course, by the time Apple is done lobbying, it could be totally neutered. So Apple's lobbying is a very loud kind of speech. If all lawmakers here is Apple's lobbying, then yes, you're totally correct. And so every single time you get pissed off and you think, hey, I want to tweet something about this, this makes me upset, or, oh man, I just read this stupid thread on Facebook, let me get real angry and spend a whole lot of time in my headspace being angry about this. If you took all of that energy and you reached out to family and friends and said, hey, this is something I care about, this is something that could affect you, please write a state official. and they got that kind of regular communication from people on the ground who are directly affected by this stuff, that's the only way that we can start introducing the first baby steps of counterpoint and counterbalance to the insane amount of money that Apple's going to spend lobbying local governments. If they start to see that people are unhappy about this stuff, politicians have a vested interest in being reelected and keeping their jobs. So there's always this feeling from Apple that nothing you do will ever change their course or behavior. And that's not true. We can affect some change. In fact, one of the stories in the gadget block is talking about Apple testing USB-C iPhones. Apparently, that well is starting to run dry and they're facing too much opposition for using a terrible connector like Lightning in the year 2022.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
Absolutely. Dave Burns, right on point. It's better to write your senator than to retweet an article, but it's best if you like, organize a protest or join an org. I would say everything helps. Spreading some kind of awareness and retweeting an article, I mean, that can help depending on the circles of family and friends who participate on social media. I just feel like there's so much noise out there that token effort of clicking a retweet button on something political like this probably doesn't influence much. But if you retweet that article, you check out the EFF, maybe you do you donate to some organizations that help support this type of legislation and this type of policy, and then you take literally something as pithy as what you would have tweeted. I agree with this. Please, support this initiative, and you have my vote. Just something like that, and send that along. I got really politically active because I actually did get some state senators to reply to internet infrastructure spending, where I was sending them links and saying, I disagree with this. It was a bill co-sponsored by John McCain, the Broadband Choice Act, which basically eliminated your ability to choose broadband providers, and Waxman's office. I actually got an email, like a form letter email. We thank you for your support of good citizenship stuff. I can't remember exactly what it said, but I actually, from his staffers, we had back and forth conversations. That matters. If they see someone's really interested in this stuff and they know about it, participation matters. Here, let me get this out of the way. Just another quick little story. And the reason why I'm popping this one up, smartphone pricing has been climbing. Excuse me. There are some companies that can play games with subsidizing the price of a phone or doing like crazy trade-in deals, or they cut prices and they put their phones on sale. I think Samsung is a really good example of a humongous organization that can kind of move money around in more interesting ways, so that if their phone division isn't performing well, or if some of their phone models aren't performing well, they can still try and move that inventory. Other companies, like, for example, Sony, I think, is a perfect example of a manufacturer that builds a slightly more boutique smartphone. So Sony is building in smaller batches. Their prices are going to be higher. And Sony isn't going to eat into their profits to build this phone. The Xperia team has been profitable for 2 years now. Like, they're finally out of the red. They're not going to throw that away to subsidize the cost so that people spend less. They're just going to try and make this phone the best package that can reasonably be made in 2022. So when we see an article like this, this is coming by way of Mariella Moon on Engadget. Samsung is reportedly raising its chip making prices by up to 20%. It's just the latest foundry business to implement a price hike. So what do we know about this? Very recently, we caught headlines that Samsung was going to be dumping, I think, upwards of $20 billion into refining their chip fabrication business, their semiconductor business. Okay, well, a sudden influx, $20 billion into this one part of their business has to be recouped. So of course, we're going to see some type of change in how they do business with their manufacturing partners. Well, now we're seeing the direct consequence of that. We're in 2022. We're facing a shortage in general. It's just super difficult for companies to get chips out the door. We have an army of like American cars that are sitting on lots that can't get car computers. I think like BMW and Mercedes even excluded features just to meet shipping deadlines. Tesla is facing some issues where they're improperly cooling AMD chipsets that they used as replacements for some of their cars. I mean, everything is horrifically constrained. And from the manufacturing, the fabrication, the packaging, the distribution, the shipping, and the assembly of all of our products, every single step of the chain has been affected. That means we have to expect higher prices on components and higher prices on the finished products once they finally make it into our hands, unless a company is so large that they can eat into their own profits or subsidize those costs. This is the right time to look at, like, do you buy what it's really worth, or are you playing a game trying to, you know, sort of get a good deal on a product? This is where a company like Sony needs all the support that they can get. So yes, it's difficult. So this is going to have a ripple effect. From Samsung, I don't know what Qualcomm's plans are for 2023, but last I read, I believe there was an attempt at locking TSMC fabrication for their next, whatever the 8 Gen 3 and 7 Gen 1 might be. We're going to see the 8 Gen 1 Plus coming out of TSMC, probably announced later this month. So Samsung, though, is probably still in line for, obviously, the Exynos. They're going to keep making that, and I hope they continue their partnership with AMD. I believe they're still doing Tensor. So Tensor and Tensor 2 are likely coming from Samsung Fab. I believe the Pixel Watch is rumored to be using an Exynos SoC, similar to the Galaxy Watches. So there's a bit that's happening in there with Samsung Semiconductor. Gary the Fireman, yeah, I guess Gen 2 Tensor, the prices are going to be going up there too. So yeah, that's going to be tricky. And if we don't pay attention to these little clues here, then we're going to get shocked when we see, oh no, the next iPhone is $100 more expensive. The next Galaxy is $100 more expensive. Look at this Sony. It's a couple $100 more expensive than the previous one. Geez, these companies are just trying to gouge us. But not really. Not when all of their manufacturing and distribution costs have skyrocketed. And we're talking about, you know, 10 to 20% price increases on these products. It kind of makes sense. All the puzzle pieces sort of fit. It's not that shocking when you're paying attention. From McCorkran, I wonder how Xperias get priced on resale market going forward. I haven't looked up the more recent ones, but just on a whim, because someone was really being pissy in the comments on my Xperia article. Because again, it's like you cherry pick. Either it's you buy Samsung because it's the most popular, or you buy Samsung because you get the best trade-in deal, or blah, 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 blah. It's never just like phone to phone. They always have to like pick one little thing that, well, I mean, obviously this is the most important aspect of owning a Samsung, so everything else is a deal breaker. But I looked it up, and on Swappa, I don't know what it looks like today, but it was last week, there was one Xperia 1 Mark 1, and it was listed at $440, And at the same time, there were a handful of Galaxy S10s that were like $150 to $170. So you're like, yeah, even with all these promises of longer software support and Samsung's best tech and ooh, DeX, you're like, no, Sony's hold their value because Sony doesn't mess around with stupid games devaluing their own products. The psychology on that matters, and Samsung is not getting that job done, inspiring consumers to actually shop at the premium tier. Takatana, when will we see Samsung-manufactured chips stop overheating? So first of all, every single processor thermal throttles. The only modern-day phones I've used that maintain like near peak performance for longer stretches of time are the Red Magics. The Red Magic phones have built-in active cooling and no water resistance to speak of. That's what you need to do. Anytime you seal up any kind of SoC, CPU, GPU, you're going to thermal throttle. Apple learned this lesson the hard way, especially going from like iPhone 11 to iPhone 12, I think, was the biggest drop. So the iPhone 12 GPU got way more powerful, but it couldn't work for as long before it throttled to below the level of the iPhone 11. Apple faced this. And the reason we don't talk about it is because too many people make money making videos about how nifty Apple is. So, you know, it's just one of those things. You just got to deal with it. I mean, they'll fix it. Software update, you know, Apple, it just works. You want your phone to just work? It's great because your phone can't do anything else, but it just works. So we're going through those teething pains now with Qualcomm and with Samsung. And I wish they would look at what the A series processor went through, especially for that GPU performance, and kind of learn some lessons instead of putting out products and learning those lessons the hard way. So the HN1 is capable of some absolutely stunning compute power. I mean, compute performance. But the performance per watt is definitely out of whack. So I can pick some of those instances where I know that this phone is going to significantly outperform like an 865, a two-year-old Android phone. I get it. It's just you have to be doing laptop-grade work to realize some of those gains. And then you have to know, like, I get about this much of a window before it's running too hot for the phone to sustain that performance. So if I'm doing short tasks in these types of arenas with this type of content, I'm getting my bang for buck. If I'm generally using my phone as a basic communicator, you should be on a Snapdragon 765. That is a brilliant chip. That is an incredible chip, supports 4K video, renders 4K video, has great facilities for photography, for video, for gaming. It's just really, I think, the one of the greatest all-rounders. That's what you should be looking at. So again, I feel like our conversation's a little out of whack when we just like, oh, their chips overheat. Every chip does. It's pretty consistent. I'm going to take a drink of coffee here. Do-do-do. Oh, yes, Gabaletta. Absolutely true. Gabaletta writes, as someone who works in the automotive retail, it's frustrating when OEMs make one car with different components because consumers are never told this when buying the car at the dealership, and then we brunt the worst of it because we should know. This is, and I feel like this needs to be a mandatory disclosure moving forward. The car is built, and consumers still think car is car. I bought Toyota car, so it Toyota. But internally, it could have any variety of different electronics, of different computers, of different pieces, of different parts, even in similar models. Sometimes, especially today, even in the same model year. And that can fundamentally change your repairs, your warranties, everything. And if we're not being, if we're not disclosing that, then we're doing consumers a significant disservice. Oh, twin folk. I bought the Galaxy S22 Plus to test out and review, and I sent that piece of garbage back so darn fast. I'm not even going to review it. I have never hated a phone so much. I was terrifically disappointed in the S22. I was still fairly encouraged by the Note 22. But again, look at what just happened there. If you try to cut corners to reduce those costs and play games with how the phone is built, you end up with a poorer experience. If you just charge more and you build that phone to the realities of the market today, and that phone gets more expensive, you end up with a better phone. Now, I still think if you have a Note 20 Ultra, you're in the same ballpark. Like, there's no point flipping a Note 20 Ultra for a Note 22. But if you were shopping a stylus-enabled phone going brand new today, and especially because Samsung's already cut prices, the Note 22 makes a lot of sense. I was very positive on that phone. I felt it performed much more. It performed much more to the levels and to the marketing, to the claims that Samsung was making. If you don't need a stylus in your phone, though, a Galaxy S21 Ultra might be a better buy. Especially because, again, those phones don't hold value. You can get them cheap. Yeah, again, I love this review from McCorkran. You know, Samsung Knights value 5 years of updates, even though they all trade in their phones every year or two. I love that argument. Like, oh, but I need 5 years of software support. But I just heard you say that you also cared about getting the best trade-in deals, which means you've got to flip your phone in 2 years, or else those trade-in values drop pretty significantly. So what game are we playing? If you're being honest with yourself, I would be the person, if I weren't a tech reviewer, I'd probably be flipping my phone every year. I'm just into this stuff. I've been into this stuff since I was in the fifth grade, and I saved up my allowance to buy a Texas Instruments pocket organizer with a QWERTY keyboard on it, and I would actually write some of my class notes on this tiny little tic-tac single-line LCD display. Like, this is just who I am. I've always been at that nerdy kid's lunch table. 5 years of software updates don't do much for me if that's the kind of lifestyle I'm in for. If I'm really going to be flipping my phone every year or two at the most, then that's the gig. There are some people who are genuinely trying to hold on to their phone for 4 and 5 years, and I don't know that a fourth operating system update really gives them the best experience. Especially playing with my Galaxy S10e, I feel like into your third real operating system update, you're now starting to stretch the software design beyond what that SoC and that hardware was intended to be capable of. So what I think is the best, you know, the sort of the best window or the best claim to make is you're going to get about 3 to 4 years of security patches guaranteed. Hopefully we're on the train for 2 to 3 major software updates. And I think there you end up with the best real experience, especially as like these phones age and the battery starts to degrade. Oh, Otaku, I like my Note 22, except the battery, which is garbage. I'll keep it for a full 4 years just so I'm justified in the purchase. You know, maybe into a year or two, you might want to flip it. I don't know. Tobias, let me answer this question, then we need to wrap up news, because we've got some real heavy stuff here too. Juan, which smartphone brand, in your opinion, brings the most premium phone experience and value between Xperia 1 Mark IV, S22 Ultra, and iPhone 13 Pro Max? I'd say all of them. You've listed three fundamentally different experiences. I feel Apple always tries to play the broadest all-rounder. I think they make the most boring devices. And I think for a certain subset of consumers who are really looking at the merit of spending more on a phone, that should appeal to them. They know what they're getting with an iPhone. It's not going to be different than the iPhone they had before it. the ability to be a little bit more powerful or have a slightly better camera is all they're really interested in. Otherwise, they just need iPhone. Great. Between a Note 22 and an Xperia, you're talking about fundamentally different ideas of productivity versus camera and gaming. If you're more into creating video content, video and cinema style content creation, or you want some of the best power management and display management tools for higher end gaming, you got to go Sony. If you're looking at the best package for work, for productivity, for desktop and laptop replacement, you got to go Samsung. And in that point, you could also throw in like a Moto, like Ready 4 goes toe-to-toe with Samsung DeX. Those are different consumers. I do not believe one person is looking at a perfect Venn diagram overlap of all of those features. Someone is going to value DeX more than power management for gaming, right? Someone is going to value a black frame insertion 240 hertz refresh over having the S Pen in the phone. Again, you've got to be able to compartmentalize what features do I care about and what compromises am I willing to live with. And I would never recommend an Xperia 1 Mark IV and a Note 22 to the same individual, because then I'm not listening to that person. I'm not listening to what they care about. I'm just selling some kind of brand loyalty and saying, well, you should just always consider all of them. Doesn't mean anything. It's like, well, do you need a turbo diesel pickup truck, or do you need a hyper-miling, small commuter hatchback? I mean, they're the same, right? They're both four wheels and four tires and a steering wheel. They must be the same. But that's what we do with smartphones. We don't actually like break down who is this right for. We instead say, this phone's the most popular, so if I make a bunch of videos on this, I'll make more money. And let me tell you, as running my YouTube channel the way that I am not making more money. Not on YouTube. So we've got a quick story here, just as the follow-up. This is becoming a farce of a business deal. Yet again, Tech Love and Mama says hello. Everyone say hey to TLM. Did I get it? Yeah, there we go. So you can kind of wave, hey, TLM. Let me get this up here. Elon Musk says the Twitter deal is on hold over concerns about number of spam accounts. Musk is, quote, still committed to the purchase amid talks he could back out or renegotiate. So I believe he's looking to renegotiate. I think he saw an opportunity and he jumped on it. Then he valued higher than he probably wanted to. And in raising the funds to actually fulfill that deal, now paying back the money, other people's money that he's raising to buy Twitter, Twitter's valuation has dropped. And it's also come at the expense of Tesla stock. So that's looking real bad. So now I think he's backpedaling. I am not a financial advisor. Don't take anything I say as any kind of financial or investment advice. But to me, this looks like someone who got bored one day, decided that he wanted to make a big stink out of making a big move, and he's an edgy meme lordy kind of guy, and that he would get all the support from all the cool kids on Reddit. He was going to go be a free speech absolutist, even though that's basically terrible for every aspect of modern day society. And in all of these shenanigans, he's dropped the price and the valuation of these two companies. He has played this poorly. So now I think he's just trying to find anything he can, any little like fingertip grip, toe hold that he can find to now go back and renegotiate something that looks a little bit better for his finances, for his pocketbook, and for all of the money that he's raising. It's just absolutely silly pants at this point. Unfortunately, I think at some point this probably still happens. Like, I think he's now committed too much energy and too much public awareness, but I also feel like Elon Musk owning Twitter is going to be one of those things where he's going to be super, super active in the in the operation for a very brief window. And then, just like with so many other things, he's going to get bored. He's going to find something else, some other shiny trinket that he's going to get interested in, and then he's going to move on. And I think Twitter is going to be so much worse for his involvement in this space. And the reason why I wanted to bring this up, first of all, it's just continuing news, right? We saw the Twitter, Elon Musk buys Twitter, and all those headlines kind of disappeared. That's not the end of the story. There's so much that needs to happen with a near hostile takeover like what we've seen. This is one of those that we follow up on just so that we're aware of what's going down. And then when suddenly things change on Twitter, we're aware as to why this stuff is going on. At the same time, from the political side of this, we're seeing some disastrous policy going up in Texas. So, actually, I'm going to do this. This is also another Ars Technica. They have a brilliant write-up on what's come, what's led to this point. Let me click this on. Again, written up by John Brodkin, who does amazing work on Ars Technica. Radical ruling lets Texas ban social media moderation based on, quote, viewpoint. The Fifth Circuit reinstates Texas law that was previously found to violate the First Amendment. In a tweet, Paxton called the ruling a big win against big tech, adding, I look forward to continuing to defend the constitutionality of HB 20. The state law says that a social media platform may not censor a user based on the user's viewpoint and define censor as block, ban, remove, deplatform, demonetize, deboost, restrict, deny equal access or visibility to, or otherwise discriminate against. The Texas Attorney General or users can sue social media platforms that violate this ban and win injunctive relief and reimbursement of court costs. In addendum, this Texas law also prohibits social media platforms from leaving the state of Texas. So this is the worst authoritarian, near corporate fascist shot against free speech that we've seen in modern history. If you claim to be a free speech absolutionist, you're lying to yourself if you support this type of initiative. No one is claiming that the current Communications Decency Act is perfect. It obviously needs some refinement, how companies can kind of hide behind the CDA, especially, what is it, Section 230? I've already spaced on what the sort of big contentious, anyway. I've explained this before, and I feel like I need to keep reiterating. Freedom of speech also means freedom from government-compelled speech. I know a lot of people like to make the argument that Twitter has become a public platform. Twitter is high visibility, but it's still a private company. Facebook is still a private company. So the state of Texas is trying to say, our government can force speech onto these platforms. We are compelling them. We are forcing them to publish speech on private infrastructure that they disagree with. It has become a cornerstone of free speech law that the government can not force you to speak if you don't want to speak. The government, again, you're not going to get thrown in jail for speaking your mind. That's the First Amendment. That is a public protection. You have to face the consequences of your free speech, but you will not be thrown into jail just for sort of saying what's on your mind. The flip side of that is the government cannot force you to say something you disagree with. That is a part, through legal precedent, that is a part of our free speech protections. So this thread here is, this law here is one of the most anti-business and anti-consumer, anti-free speech pieces of legislation I've ever seen in my entire life. First of all, you can't be pro-business and then say, we're not going to allow you to stop doing business with us. You have to do business with us or face legal penalties and we'll sue you and we'll initiate lawsuits. That can't happen. The constitutionality of that is already supremely suspect. But the other reason why I wanted to bring this up, last week we talked about how ISPs had finally given up trying to fight net neutrality in the state of California. And we're still in gridlock. We're still in a deadlock at the FCC, where we're long overdue trying to start the process of establishing a federal standard for net neutrality and Title II regulation over the internet. These articles, I feel, are missing one critical small piece of this conversation. So I'm not picking on John Brodkin here. Excuse me. The judges struggle with basic tech concepts. Oral arguments were held on Monday this week, and the judges seemed to struggle with basic tech concepts. Judges were skeptical of arguments made by tech industry groups NetChoice and the Computer and Communications and Industry Association, which sued Texas to block the law. One judge suggested that Twitter isn't even a website, and another wondered if phone companies have a First Amendment right to kick people off their services. Judge Edith Jones, I'm trying to find the quote, your clients are internet providers. They are not websites. So I need that to ring just a little bit. One of the judges has called these individual internet social media companies internet providers. Okay. So in this right here, and especially in this chat, that sounds like a complete disassociation of how modern technology works, right? We all understand the relationship between an individual, a company that gets them internet access, and then services that live on the internet. One of the critical things that I think these articles have missed is currently, our internet is regulated as an information service. I think it's very telling that they're bringing up telephones, because telephone infrastructure is regulated as a telecommunication service. Remember, all the doom and gloom, the agit-pi years of the FCC, nothing's going to change when we remove net neutrality. But the major push of the open internet order was to regulate the internet as a telecommunication service, was to regulate as if it were a utility, which it is. Your telephone service, your television service, that's regulated as telecommunication. The internet is an information service. Telecommunication service, again, I'm being very broad here, and you can look up these legal definitions. I did a video on this on reviews.org. It's one of the least viewed videos we've ever produced on reviews.org. But telecommunication services are basically these core utility services. Information services are smaller services that operate on telecommunication services. The original idea of the internet was built on phone lines. So the internet in the earliest days of dial-up, that was an information service, dial-up internet, that lived on a telecommunication service, telephone lines. These judges aren't as dumb as people are making them out to be. The definition of an information service is an internet service provider, and is Google, and is Facebook, and is Twitter. Legally, by the definition of how we're regulating the internet today, your relationship with an ISP is legally regulated and defined in the same way as your relationship with Facebook. This is a backwards interpretation of that, where now we can say Facebook is the same as an internet service provider. Because legally, it kinda is. They're both regulated as information services. These judges are actually interpreting the federal standard correctly, if backwards. That is what is so dark and so insidious about why the Trump administration, how the Trump administration gutted net neutrality. In this modern era today, your telephone is basically a data service that lives on the internet, but we still regulate telephone infrastructure as a telecommunication service. You know, phone is probably the least used app on your smartphone, if we're being honest. But the way that we've allowed Title II to get gutted means that this interpretation is kind of legally correct. And that's why every single time I say, like, hey, it's worth writing a congressman, it's worth writing a senator, it's worth getting involved at, you know, the state and local level, this is the kind of stuff that matters. I'm hoping that some of the momentum in California is going to create a direct legal showdown with what's going on in Texas. And then the Washington Post has published, I think this was 2 days ago, tech groups ask Supreme Court to block Texas social media law. I'm not confident in our current Supreme Court to interpret this case correctly. This is a hugely partisan effort where conservatives have been able to sort of jerry-rig and gerrymander support for this notion that they're the only ones who are being silenced on social media. Twitter has a strong left-wing bias. We've been fighting this since before the pandemic in earnest. Literally before all of the lockdowns happened, even on my podcast, we were looking at those stories coming out of the UK of people torching 5G antennas because they were sort of the victims of supreme and targeted disinformation campaigns. We're seeing the fallout and the impact of misinformation and disinformation infiltrating tiny little communities on Facebook. And then by the time it spreads to larger platforms, it's already too late. You've already poisoned the well for all of those people that were following that misinformation. If we don't push back against this type of fake free speech protection, we're going to end up with less free speech. Everything that we do in this space requires a soft touch and reactionary regulation. If we don't have some basic protections in place, consumers are going to get hurt. As we've seen with some of the scarier stories that have come out over the last couple days, this type of weaponized misinformation and indoctrination happens in tiny, tiny little pockets and then festers and then spreads. We don't have good tools to fight it. It's so casual and it's so easy to say, well, I think every idea should be put out there so that consumers can make up their own minds. And if it's really a better idea, then the merit of that idea is going to win. Because we know that's not true. We know that's not how any of this works. We know the psychology is people will seek out that information which confirms some feeling that they have. And you can twist that information to get them to do things that you want them to do. I mean, that's a lot of politics, right? You already have a strong feeling about this one topic, so vote for me. That's the basic level of this, right? That kind of conditioning and call to action. But what we're seeing instead is now increasing threat and risk. If it's misinformation about vaccines, if it's flat earthers calling skepticism into the scientific method, if it's 5G causes COVID, you know, people are going to go out there and torch 5G towers. It's so easy for a tiny little group of bad actors from state government, from other governments around the world, to infiltrate tiny little communities, you know, a PTA association in Podunt, South Dakota. And then suddenly there's this hotbed of sharing bad information that then spiderwebs out from a small little infiltration, depending on how all this stuff works. And we've seen case after case after case and study after study that deplatforming people that basically just lie on social media is currently one of the only effective methods of stopping the spread and stopping the indoctrination of new followers. It doesn't save anyone who's already swallowed that pill, but it stops more people from finding the bad information and getting in line in the wrong line. So this bill from Texas is a clear shot against free speech. And I don't know how better to break that down. If you're forcing a private company to publish things that they disagree with, that run afoul of their own terms of service, as protected and verified by the FTC and the Communications Decency Act, then you are crippling the sort of social fabric built around the First Amendment. It's basically the worst thing that could happen to online speech and discourse. It's awful. So again, where I would ask anyone to spend time not just retweeting things on Twitter or, you know, just getting really angry and letting it kind of fester in your brain, get this stuff to your elected officials. Link these things, talk about these things, share these things, and make sure your voice is heard opposite some of the worst bad actors with their own self-interests at play. It's time our interests were reflected in this political discourse. So, that's the news block. Went long on the news block, dang it.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey everyone, this is Zach of Zach Talks Tech. If you're looking to make sense of the tech that you love, if you're looking for an unfiltered opinion, someone who's just straight to the gun, gets right to it, no nonsense, come on over to Zach Talks Tech. I stream 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 9:15 p.m. Eastern, and then I cut up clips of that show and I throw them out there for you on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But if you want to be part of the live show, check it out Monday, Wednesday, Fridays at 9:15 p.m. Eastern. Check it out, Zach Talks Tech on YouTube. That's ZAKTALKSTECH, or as they call it up here in Canada, it could also be Zed. ZAKTALKSTECH. Check them out on all the socials. We'll see you there.
Folks, I'm obviously very passionate about this. I still haven't found many good arguments against a federal standard for net neutrality. And this is great evidence for me to say, yeah, the internet should not be regulated the same way as services on the internet. So it's a bummer. It's a bummer. All right, why don't we shout out the subreddit real quick, because I had a pretty good week on the subreddit, and there was definitely a theme of popular products on the subreddit. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. This is my little pet project. The whole point of the subreddit is to try and get, is to try and share content we feel deserves more attention. So if you check out the subreddit, number one, the One More Evo review, that is the top voted story of the last week. Immediately, number two, Koki Yamaguchi, 70,000 subscribers, Sony Xperia 1 Mark IV, camera test and first impressions, took the number two spot. Number three spot, hey, it's me again, Xperia 1 Mark IV. And then in the number four, we've got Twinfolk. I think Twinfolk, is Twinfolk still in the chat? I don't know if he's still in the chat. Doing a Google I.O. recap. And then number five, rounding out the top five, Ben's Gadget Reviews, a channel I've really been enjoying lately. Sony Xperia 1 Mark IV review. I don't know if I agree that you can call it a review, but some really good stuff from Ben in using the Xperia 1. Last week's podcast made a pretty decent showing. There was a question. I can't sort of speak out this username. It's 0B11111100001. Just asking a question, and I thought this was kind of an interesting conversation starter. How can I get the most out of smaller channel reviewers? So asking about people that don't have the largest followings, and then, you know, how to sort of convince the algorithm at YouTube that that's the kind of content that you want to engage with. In the top 10, my 4K Netflix editorial is in the top 10. And we've got more Xperia content. We've got some IEM content. TK Bay, checking out the Honor Magic 4, my emergency prep tech video, a podcast from Adam Dowd, Nord, El Jefe Reviews, 24 hours with the Sony XM5. If you're interested in these Sony cans, I can think of few people I would trust their opinion on more than Jeff over at El Jefe Reviews. And of course, always making an appearance, I'm always super stoked to see Tech Potato, Dr. Ian, chatting the future of Intel CPU design. This was a great week on the subject. We had Gary Explains, we had Digital Slang, we had a huge number and a huge variety of different content creators and different tech topics. NVIDIA Linux drivers, earbuds, headphones, a lot of Sony Xperia content that was definitely hot on the channel this, on the podcast this, the podcast, on the subreddit this week. some really, really, really good stuff. If you would like to support your favorite content creators, this is one of the places I'm building to try and help spread the word. We're talking about algorithms and SEO and social media, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. We're growing slowly, grassroots, a trickle of new users every week. We're at 2,400 members on the community now. And we're getting amazing submissions, but we always need more upvotes. And to be people for people to be generous, like there's a good reason why this content gets shared on the site. I don't think people need to be precious with, well, I'm going to click this one up arrow, but the rest of these not worth it. If you want that broader look at tech, if you want a larger community that's not just YouTube algorithm, you will not find a broader look at what's going on in consumer electronics right now, especially for this being one of the few subreddits where people are even allowed to self-promote. A lot of subreddits you go and you try and share your own video and you're going to get banned. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Comments, sharing, upvotes. We need that support. Again, I'm seeing 44 people in this live stream right now. The top voted post had 15 upvotes last week. If half of you went and upvoted a couple of the submissions on the subreddit, you would radically change what the next most popular videos and articles are for next week. Literally one click of an up arrow. If half of you did that, if 22 of you did that, you would be able to dictate who was the number one submission next week. That's what we're talking about. I mean, that level of effort. Do you want to support people making amazing content? That's a pretty easy way to do it. So, Dave Burns, hey, I go through an upvote every night as penance. Oh, Twin Folk is. Twin Folk is in the chat. Yeah, Twin Folk writes, if it weren't for glowing rectangles, I'd have zero subscribers. So Twin Folk, I mean, what are you at? 20 subscribers? Is that? Yeah. So I see Twin Folk has 20 subscribers. I'm subscribed. Are you subscribed to Twin Folk? Twin Folk is active in this community. He's literally in this chat right now. Again, if all 44 of you were subscribed, we could easily double the number of subscribers that Twin Folk has. He's trying to put together good content. He definitely needs feedback. He wants to participate. He's engaged in these conversations. Can we get him 10 more subscribers before the end of this podcast? Is that something we could do? Twin Folk is good tech, is good people. Been in this chat right now, so it's not like a mystery who this guy is. If you go to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and you hover over Twin Folk's submission, you'll get a little bubble that says you can subscribe, and you can click on that, and you can subscribe to his channel. It's literally that easy. And that's how we can support and contribute to all the people making awesome stuff in our community. All the people in my neighborhood. This is my neighborhood. And I hope you'll support it. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. So, why don't we jump into the gadget block here. Let me get this out of the way. I just want to get this story up. So I only had one major link, and this is like a rumor post. I hate doing leaks and rumors, and this one's kind of like a no-duh kind of story. I just hate that it's kind of like building traction as if this is like a foregone conclusion or it's a huge deal. But a number of outlets, this is coming by way of Bloomberg, but a number of outlets have been reporting that Apple is testing iPhones that ditch Lightning ports in favor of USB-C. There's legislation on the books in the EU that all consumer electronics like phones and tablets are going to have to start using USB-C, and Apple is going to change that over. Excuse me. Maybe we'll see, you know, USB-C on a pair of AirPods and USB-C on the iPhones, and it's already there on the iPads, and the Apple Magic Mouse is a terrible design, so it's time that Apple fixes the Magic Mouse and puts a USB-C port on it. Twin folk, if Apple gets USB-C, we'll probably still get a max of like 20 watt charging. I'm sitting in front of a bunch of phones. Like, I've got my iQOO. Let me tell you, 100 watt charging is pretty rad. I had to leave the house and I was like, oh no, this phone only has 20% charge. That's not going to be enough. I plugged the phone in. I went downstairs. I put on my shoes. I tied my shoes. I walked back upstairs and the phone had like 55% charge. Like, this is so silly pretending Samsung and Apple have fast charging. Because, boy, howdy, is it not fast. So the only reason why I want to throw this out here is because we're all sort of piling on this story as if it's a real big deal. Oh, my gosh, Apple, USB-C, isn't this what we've always wanted? I'm of the mind that it is not outside the realm of consideration that just because Apple is testing USB-C, it doesn't mean we're going to get it. I still feel there are small but significant Vegas odds that by 2024, Apple blows our minds with a portless iPhone, where following the letter of the law in this EU regulation that's going down, Apple will make a product that has no charge port. You can only charge it over MagSafe, over their wireless charging. But the MagSafe is going to use USB-C. So the final terminal going to the charge brick will be USB-C, but you'll need to buy a more expensive magnetic puck, and you'll need to buy more expensive charge cables so that Apple can continue operating profits. Because, like, oh, I've got them over there on the floor. The reason why Lightning has stuck around for so long is because Apple makes a ton of money on Lightning cables, Lightning adapters, Lightning dongles, and licensing all of that to third-party manufacturers. You can't really license USB-C the same way. Apple can't make money on USB-C accessories the same way that they make money on Lightning accessories. It eventually hit a tipping point for the iPad. Makes sense. They were trying to build the iPad as like a laptop replacement. They were dealing with schools, and schools had different considerations and different certifications and regulations on how their products could be used. That makes sense. You want to sell more iPads. Eventually, you switch it over into a more universal cable standard. But the iPhone has been able to sort of skirt all of that. They've never had to use micro USB. I still think it's possible we don't see an iPhone with USB-C. And I think, again, Apple has a core entrenched user base that will just follow whatever they say is, well, Apple did it, so it's the cool thing to do. And then from there, a year later in 2025, Samsung will copy them.
Yeah.
Twinfolk, I agree. A portless phone is a slap in the face to consumers. Dr. Claw, portless is useless. Farhan, speaking of portless iPhones, I read an article on Flipboard that Steve Jobs originally developed the first iPhone to be SIM-less. That wasn't actually too crazy of an idea. I don't know if people remember, but you know, Sprint phones didn't really have SIMs in them. EVDO and CDMA tech was sort of built around, you know, the chip in the phone communicating with the cell tower and being whitelisted. And Steve Jobs wanted that, but they wanted to work with AT&T as like their main, as their main partner. So it really didn't make sense to like enclose the SIM card. Get this out of the way here. So I don't think that this is a foregone conclusion. I would love to see USB-C on an iPhone. I feel like the further I get, the more I wish I could just use an iPad mini. The only product that I would really want to use as a daily driver smartphone from Apple is the iPad mini. It's a little too big just to kind of walk around with an iPad mini in your pocket. But, you know, if I'm regularly walking around with a backpack, I wish I could get an iPad mini, connect my Apple Watch directly to the iPad mini, and take phone calls and iMessages over a SIM card and over 5G, just like I could with an iPhone. There is nothing about the iPhone that interests me. I want better multitasking. I want better support for accessories. I want a standardized universal cable, a USB-C cable. I want everything that the iPad mini has to offer, but I want it to be my phone. And I can't get that. And it's such a bummer because while I've been, you know, sort of like, oh man, you know, folding screens and tablets and stuff, that's kind of what I have with my Duo 2. Minus the fact that there's a hinge that folds the phone into one panel, this is kind of like just walking around with an iPad mini as your phone. And it's kind of great. And being able to do two things side by side is kind of awesome. And I would be down for that. Even without an iPad mini folding in half, I would still prefer that over using an iPhone. Like everything about iPad OS, minus the phone calling and smartwatch omissions, fixes what bugs me about iOS. I want iPad OS on a phone. So, you know, McCorkerin is totally correct. If it would be expensive for Apple to have separate manufacturing processes in different regions, it will be USB-C everywhere if it happens. But I also think that, like, it'll be MagSafe everywhere if they decide to go portless. Because I feel like there's probably also going to be some buffer or leeway where Apple can still sell older iPhones for another year or two. And Apple might, like, okay, well, the EU says everything has to have USB-C. These are older products. They're still on store shelves. They were, you know, made or distributed before a certain cutoff through the EU. And we'll make adapters more available to consumers on the ground as we sort of make our way through this diminishing stockpile of older devices. And I think you could probably get a good year and a half or maybe even 2 years out of that kind of a strategy. So it's kind of a bummer. Apple always gets to play by totally different rules from everyone else. And then we're like, oh, well, how come theirs just always the bestest? And you're like, yeah, because they don't have any oversight or anyone telling them they can't do things. I feel if more governments said, hey, don't do that, then Apple wouldn't be viewed as any kind of exceptional option in this competitive landscape. I mean, like, someone mentioned, you know, like, maybe, you know, like, if it ran Windows or something like that. But again, if it runs Windows, it's subject to actual regulations. You know, anything Microsoft does is, like, combed over with a fine-tooth comb to, like, oh, are you breaking a regulation? Are you breaking a law? We're going to fine you for that. Did you include a web browser with Windows XP? Oh, we can't have that. We need consumer choice. Oh, but you want to just let Apple do everything they want with payment services? Sure. What's Apple going to do? They're nifty. So it's just a bummer. All right, 10:30. We got a good half hour. What do we want to chat about? Do you guys have any questions? Guys and gals, excuse me, and tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions. Xperia 1 Mark IV. I've been using this for a couple weeks now. I've been very encouraged by the direction that Sony is traveling. I think I accidentally let this phone die. It might not be charged, so I might not be able to just show you the screen. Let's see if it boots up. Design, form factor, very much in keeping with previous Xperias. I've got my 1 Mark II right next to it with my broken, busted-ass case for the 1 Mark II. Nearly identical. It's shocking. The 1 Mark IV is ever so slightly a little thicker, but it's, I mean, we're talking like a fraction of a millimeter here, but it's a little shorter. Like the 1 Mark II is actually a little bit taller. I've really been enjoying Sony's. Oh, it does have trim charge. It's 50% on the battery. That's good. Sony. I'll just hold this up here. For all the audio listeners on the podcast, look at this beautiful phone. I actually just stalled right there because I kind of needed to snort and I didn't want that to go over the mic. So I just muted myself there for a second. Audio listeners, you're welcome. So the Xperia has been a really interesting phone to cover because so much of this conversation from the leaks and the rumors was grossly incorrect. So many people were focused on camera tech. So Sony's going to step up to larger 48 megapixel image sensors. Totally didn't happen. There was a rumor Sony's going to add a fourth camera for better zoom management. Totally didn't happen. And especially like looking at where we were with the 1 Mark III, none of this stuff should have been too surprising. The 1 Mark III introduced a two-stage telephoto. So you could go at one focal length or another, but you couldn't smoothly zoom between those two focal lengths. So why would you ever need multiple telephoto camera sensors if you have a real lens that can change its focal length? You only need one sensor and a zoom lens. And now that's what we have on the 1 Mark IV. From, I think it's 85 millimeters to 120 millimeters, which isn't huge, but it's another X, right? We go from 3X to 4X zoom. You have actual optical telephoto, which is incredible. Like, that's amazing. A telephoto zoom built into a phone this radically thin. The cameras have been solid. I do wish we could step up to larger camera sensors because I was kind of spoiled by the Xperia Pro I. That real big sensor with the variable aperture was super fun to play with. But the bigger update for the 1 Mark IV is 120 frame per second 4K video on all three sensors. So you can shoot 4K 120 from the telephoto with the variable zoom. You can shoot it from the main sensor and you can shoot it from the ultra wide. So yet another step towards refining and focusing the Xperia 1 series in a way that makes sense for photography professionals, journalists, and people that have an eye towards a certain kind of cinema content creation for mobile devices. Is that broad? Not at all. Nothing about an Xperia is ever average consumer. But the actual performance of this phone has been very encouraging for the people who I think this would be a good fit for. So yeah, we do have some questions here. Let me scroll back up. Dave Burns started us off. Dave, how much gooder is the Sony? It is at least 7 more gooder. So from Farhan, have there been any improvements on the Photo Pro and Cinema Pro app? They seem about the same. I am on a prototype. This isn't finished hardware, and it's definitely not finished software. At present, the main updates seem to have come to Video Pro. There are three main camera apps. You've got Photo Pro, Video Pro, and Cinema Pro. Video Pro is the one that's getting more of the polish on like continuous zoom. This is one of the only phones, when you're shooting 4K 30 frame per second video, this is one of the only phones that truly will zoom all the way across all three sensors in one continuous video. I think someone got real pedantic. It's not seamless zoom because you can see when the sensor changes and there's like a tiny little stutter. And you're like, it is seamless zoom because almost no other phone will let you switch between all three camera sensors in one video clip. So I had to mute that person. They're never going to comment on my channel ever again that I can see. Photo Pro and Cinema Pro seem about the same. Cinema Pro is a very locked down, very focused workflow for shooting sort of a wide aspect ratio, 21:9 aspect ratio video. Photo Pro is the same. The major improvements came, I think, last generation, where they included the basic mode, some better auto mode processing. Obviously, Sony's have like low light, night modes, HDR, all that stuff is still there. So the improvements seem more focused on Video Pro and then just the hardware. So like the eye tracking has gotten better, the sensor readout has gotten faster, all of that stuff has been polished up. Oh, from Rami, hold on, let me just read this off here. Hello, Juan. In Finland, we have the Xperia 1 Mark IV, 12 gigs of RAM with 256 gigs of storage with a pair of WH-1000XM4 headphones for €1,399. Deliveries begin in June. I would like to order it. On the other hand, could still wait a year for the Xperia 1 Mark V. It's a difficult decision. The 1 Mark III is still baller. It's still a great option. You would really have to look at some of those little finer point details. The 1 Mark IV definitely gets better battery life, especially when you're using it for the phone stuff. Both the Mark III and the Mark IV are going to nuke your battery when you're driving the screen really bright and you're shooting tons of 4K video and it's hot outside and the phone's having to manage your data connection. No phone sustains that kind of workload well. You're going to tank that battery. 4K 120 across all three sensors is pretty trick. And the slightly brighter screen is nicer too. It's definitely brighter than my 1 Mark II. My 1 Mark II is hard to read in direct sun. The 1 Mark III was pretty good. The 1 Mark IV has gotten even another step noticeably better. But 256 gigs of storage with upgradable storage and a headphone jack is still phenomenal. And when you do the math, it's kind of like $100 cheaper-ish, if I'm doing the conversion in my head right, than what we'll get here in the United States. In the United States, we're only getting the 512 gig version, and it's going to cost $1,600. And I'm kind of fine with that. It's expensive. It definitely narrows the recommendation list of people who I think will enjoy that phone. But again, I still have, like, the United States, we don't sell many of these Sonys, and often they go to the original Xperia Pro sold like hotcakes to universities and to local news stations. Like, it really was a pro phone for very professional use cases. And I kind of feel the 1 Mark IV is now kind of crossing over. It's obviously Sony wants to sell as many of these as they can. But at $1,600, it really is tipping into a more product-specific, audience-specific, professional work device. I would recommend an Xperia 1 easily to a photojournalist or someone working for a news station. If you want like the fastest, most immediate way to capture content, upload it, edit it, live stream directly from other nicer camera packages, work with, you know, live streaming plugins or news broadcast, you know, media servers, it's an Xperia. You really shouldn't be messing with anything else. It's that good. It's a slightly harder conversation for someone who's like, I like to watch TikToks and I want really juicy HDR social media photos. That's obviously not going to get the same kind of recommendations. Let's see. Oh, Dave Burns actually asking a real question. Is the amp and DAC any better, or is it still just Qualcomm okay? So I've done some testing. I'm going to be writing up some of my results on the Patreon. None of my results can be taken as finished review content. But so far, I'm very encouraged by the speaker performance. I'm a little concerned about the headphone performance, but my phone is a prototype. So I can't say that that's for certain what the retail units are going to get. But Sony has never put in a huge amp on any of their phones. So the amp is pretty easily outperformed by gaming phones, obviously by LGs. And there are a couple mid-rangers, like the Poco X4. Surprisingly decent audio playback on the Poco X4. And you know, if you're only buying a Sony just for the headphone jack, you want to buy a Sony because you get all the premium tier pro phone features and a headphone jack. But this is a part of the Alpha team. I don't see anything about an Xperia that speaks to the Sony Walkman division, you know, the MP3 player division. The Alpha team, I feel they look at their phone and they say, cameras need audio inputs. So the easiest way for us to add an audio input is to put a headphone jack on this phone. And that way you have an analog audio input and you leave your data port free if you need to charge it or if you need to transfer data. That's the best way to do it. So that's what I feel the primary purpose of a headphone jack on a Sony is. And then it also, it's a benefit for gaming. You know, it's going to power most gaming headsets fine, but I don't believe Sony has ever looked at their phone and thought audiophile grade, top tier reproduction of high bit rate, super beautiful music files. It just doesn't seem to be a part of the Xperia DNA right now. Yeah, from Farhan, if I recall, Sony didn't want to compromise the camera DRAM performance, hence no 48 megapixel or quad Bayer sensor. I feel like the newest pixel binning sensors have gotten noticeably better at autofocus, but none of them have matched just the insane raw speed of clearing data off of a traditional RGB sensor. So, you know, like when you see 12 megapixels and you go, oh, why is Sony using such a crap sensor? That traditional RGB pixel layout clears data insanely fast and is faster and more accurate for autofocus. Sony has always been upfront. That is their main focus, literally, pun intended, is you hold up your phone and if there's a person standing in front of your camera sensor, it immediately locks focus on their eye faster than RoboCop or Skynet. It's spooky fast. And now they're clearing autofocus performance in between burst photo images. If you check out TK's video on the One Mark IV, we were working with Clark Wolf, and she's an amazing host. She's been on AMC's Talking Dead. She's really lovely, just amazing to work with. And we wanted to do something fun to shoot samples off of camera phones. And so we were out in the field and he did a test. It was dusk, lower light conditions, not direct sunlight. Some area where this medium-sized camera sensor would actually start to struggle. And as she's walking to the camera, he's holding a burst of photos and every single one is tack sharp on her eyeball as she's walking into the camera. It's like nothing I've ever seen from a phone. It genuinely is just almost like time travel good. Like being able to read the movement of the moment and capture what's happening in that sequence by focusing on an eyeball is insane. And again, from the One Mark II to the Pro I to the One Mark IV, no phone has kept up with like my rambunctious 6-year-old daughter nearly as well. From pulling the phone out of your pocket and pushing a button to start taking the photo, it is tracking movement and tracking subjects like nothing you've ever seen on a phone. It's really something special. DTNL. So it's like a big boy camera lens, which can focus at any length in between 85 and 125. So it, not that it focuses, it's that it the focal length can change between 85 to 125. So if you want a 100 millimeter equivalent lens, it's optical. That is an optical 100 millimeter equivalent lens. Beyond 125, it will do cropping to 300 millimeters. The digital crop is okay. I feel like Sony isn't as good at the extreme AI computational making up information game. So like a OnePlus at the far end of the zoom and a Sony at the far end of the zoom, the OnePlus is going to have better image processing for sharpening and making up data. When you really crop down on that telephoto sensor, I feel the Sony falls behind a little bit when we're at the extreme end. But in that middle tier, I'd say even out to around the equivalent of around 200 millimeters, it's really tough to beat. It's really hard to compete directly against what Sony is offering in terms of actual optical and photo output performance. If you just want to make up blurry, splotchy, watercolor, fake sharpened HDR photos, Samsung, yeah, the Samsung will win. But when you want to break down like what the camera is actually capable of resolving and the data that you really get to work with, it's Sony all day, every day. It really is very good. Oh, Takatana, I wish I had any information on this. Will the Pro I Mark II have continuously variable aperture? Given the realities of manufacturing this year, I'm not confident that we'll see a Pro I Mark II or a 5 Mark IV. A little behind the scenes, you know, I don't like giving away all the information from like the pre-briefs and the PR conversations that we have with these companies. But when the 1 Mark III was announced to reviewers, because there's always a gap, right? They announce the phone and then it doesn't go on sale for like 4 months. And I don't understand why people have such a hard time with that. If you're a fan of Xperia's and you want to know that a new one is coming, now you know that a new one will arrive and you can save up your money for it. It's not an issue. If you like what a Sony can do, you now have a choice. You can go and buy an Xperia 1 Mark III now. You can wait for the actual retail release of the 1 Mark IV and buy that. Or you can wait for the retail release of the 1 Mark IV and get a small cost savings on the 1 Mark III instead. Like, this is easy. Only tech reviewers act like, oh, it's too late. Sony missed their window of arbitrary timing that no consumer cares about, but techies read articles and get real upset about Sony because they already own iPhones. Like, that doesn't exist. No one accidentally stumbles onto an Xperia. Oops, I spent $1,600. How come this phone isn't like an iPhone? That never happens. You have to buy Sony deliberately. You have to shop Sony with purpose. I digress. When the 1 Mark III came out, there was a tease that a 5 Mark III would follow. Sony hasn't given us a tease on a 5 Mark IV. Now, I don't know if that means there will not be a 5 Mark IV or if they can't iterate on the 5 for the new technologies that they're incorporating into the 1 Mark IV. And also, we don't have any tangible data on a follow-up to the Pro I. Given what the mission of the Pro I is, I honestly wouldn't be surprised if Sony just rode that phone for another year. They went a little long on the original Sony Pro. Like, I think you can still buy the original Sony Pro. The Pro I is, again, it's a very specific kind of device, and it is not meant to be broad. It is not meant to be mainstream. It it's okay because of the way that they're working the optics on that phone. I think it's okay if that phone is a 2-year phone. I don't think you can do that with the Xperia 1. The 1 needs to be a yearly iterative improvement showcasing sort of the most consumer accessible technologies, but with a focus on high level, high concept content creation and gaming. So I'll be really curious to see. It could very well be Sony in 2022, with tons of manufacturing issues, with tons of distribution issues, with tons of component issues, that Sony plays this year safe, just releasing the One Mark IV and the new Xperia 10. I don't know that that's going to happen. I don't know what they're going to plan. I wouldn't be surprised if that's what goes down. From Barry Johnson. Barry writes, September can't get here fast enough. I apologize, chat. I don't think I will be sending Juan any more Samsungs to test. I am moving to Sony. So Barry kicked my ass. He was like, hey man, I'm getting the Note 22. I've got all these Samsung points. I'm going to get a great deal on it. Are you going to cover the phone? And I wrote him back and I said, like, I will eventually review the Note 22, but I'm not going to jump on this, you know, pre-release, on pre-orders. And he's like, shut up. I'm going to get the phone. You're going to use it for a couple weeks and then send it back to me. And that's the only reason why I had any kind of early commentary on the S22 and the Note 22 was because of TK and Barry Johnson. Because I'm very cranky about Samsung right now. I really don't feel they're living up to their own marketing and their own expectations. So, Barry, when September gets here and when the Xperia launches, I think you're really going to dig that. I know you really enjoyed the iQOO. I sent Barry my iQOO 9 Pro, and Kimmy, Gadget Goddess, also seems to be rocking more Vivo gear. And I think Sony's game is really, really strong. I've been very disappointed by Samsung. Xiaomi has been surprisingly quiet. Lots of mid-ranger activity, lots of Poco, lots of Redmi. But the actual Xiaomi 12 hasn't really hit as aggressive as I thought Xiaomi was going to was going to play at the top end, at the high end of the smartphone market. So really this year, I kind of feel like it's BBK's game to lose. When you've got Realme, OnePlus, Oppo, and Vivo all punching well above their competitor price tags with absolutely stunning hardware. I've been critically excited for what Vivo has been doing from the X70 Pro Plus to the iQOO 9 Pro. I am so anxious about the X80 Pro. Looks like it's going to be a stunning camera platform. So I kind of feel like Sony is going to occupy this pro photographer niche, and they're the kings of that niche. For something more mainstream or something more well-rounded, I think it's Vivo. I think Vivo does it. I think Vivo gets that done. I haven't been as impressed by Samsung. I've been surprisingly impressed by Motorola. I was doing low light nighttime photography on the Moto Edge, and those images look better than the post-processing that comes out of the Note 22. Like, Samsung goes crazy overboard on saturation and white balance, and I look like neon puke urine yellow on these street lamps. And then I fire up the Moto and they're like, no, this is what the accurate white balance would look like if you wanted true white for your subject. And I'm like, holy cow, a Moto did this. I've never been this impressed by Motorola cameras before. This game is wide open right now. Gaming phones have been incredible. Productivity phones have never been stronger, never been better at replacing your laptop. High horsepower content creation devices, mini tablet. This is still a ridiculously silly beta test, right? Putting hinges on a phone. If it's a Duo, if it's a Galaxy Fold, if it's a Vivo, if it's an Oppo, this is not mainstream consumer ready. This is really good. a Duo 2 has gotten really good. The Z Fold has gotten pretty good. I'm very anxious to see if we're going to get a OnePlus foldable built on the Oppo, the Find N. This stuff is awesome. Just seriously, the market has never been this broadly competitive, while at the same time, we're acting like, if it's not an iPhone or a Samsung, I can't make money on the YouTubes. Any reviewer who's acting like that, you can immediately ignore any opinion that they've got.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
So Aditya is saying, I really hope they can port the seamless Zoom onto other older phones. I don't think they're going to be able to. I think it's in part hardware because of how the sensors clear data, and in part software for how they're getting the phone to communicate through the SoC to talk to those camera sensors. So unfortunately, I don't believe, like if you have a One Mark III, I don't think you're gonna get the same seamless zoom in Video Pro. I think that's gonna be a hardware restriction. From Gabaletta, how's the output from the main sensor compared to the Pro I? Is there big noticeable differences in output or is it comparable? So if you want, I've done numerous videos on things like talking about sensor size. So I did one video breaking down, why do we call a sensor a 1-inch sensor? That's a great starting place just to get an understanding of I've got these coffee burps like crazy today. That's a great starting point just to understand the surface area and the physics of why we've built our camera systems around this form factor, this size. And then from there, I did a shootout. So at the end of last year, I got the Pixel 6 Pro, the Vivo X70 Pro Plus, and the Xperia Pro I. And each of those has a usable sensor surface area around 1 over 1.3 inches. And again, that's if you want to see in that video, you can see three of the heaviest hitting camera phone platforms that are currently available to buy. When we increase sensor size, we change the lens, the optics, the crop factor changes, the equivalent aperture changes. And by the time we get to a Vivo X70 Pro Plus, the equivalent focal length and equivalent aperture is right in line with my Panasonic. So this is my Panasonic G9. This is a $1,000 lens on my Panasonic. This is the 12-35. At 12 millimeters, this is the equivalent field of view as a 24 millimeter lens on a full frame camera, like a Sony A7. So it's a crop factor of 2. Now, this lens is in actuality an f2.8 aperture. So it's a consistent aperture from 12 to 35. But the equivalent view of this lens is around f5.6 on a full frame camera. Crop factor of 2, multiply the aperture by 2, you end up with the equivalent look. And it's very easy to demonstrate. Like this camera, the lens that I have on the streaming camera is an f1.4. And I shot against a Sony at f2.8 and at a similar field of view, an equivalent focal length, f1.4 looks like f2.8 on a full frame camera. f2.8 on this Panasonic looks like f5.6 on a full frame camera. Where is my X70? Here. This X70 Pro Plus has the equivalent of a 23 millimeter lens and the equivalent aperture of f5.6 on a full frame camera. If you compare raw files, not portrait mode, not HDR, not Zeiss color, raw file to raw file, the equivalent field of view looks very similar, both in terms of focal length and in terms of aperture. So when you significantly change the sensor size on a camera, you fundamentally change the optics, the field of view, the bokeh, the depth of field. So a Pro Eye is going to outperform an Xperia 1 main sensor to main sensor. They both can do the 4K 120 frame per second trick. The Xperia Pro Eye has a variable aperture, so you can stop that lens down for better bright light conditions. But where the Xperia 1 is going to be stronger is on the ultra wide and the telephoto, also being able to clear 4K 120. And the variable zoom is so much stronger on the Xperia 1 than the 2x zoom is on the Xperia Pro Eye. The Pro Eye is really built around that main camera sensor. I think the Xperia 1 Mark IV is better well-rounded across all three camera sensors. So it really depends. Like if you're just going to live on the main sensor, I'd say, you know, still shop the Pro Eye. If you want the best all-around camera package, it might be the Pro Eye. Yeah, and Farhan's also saying the slightly larger than 10% bump in battery capacity also seems to have helped the Xperia 1 Mark IV. Dustadori. But it can't do the unicorn puke as pukey as a Samsung. This is true. The HDR output is very traditional HDR. Like, it really is just about sort of reining in highlights and boosting shadow detail. Samsung is not layering on a ton of sharpening, contrast, saturation. The vibrance is not going to compare. But then you end up with a photo that you slap a filter on it in Instagram, and I think it can look better. You can really dial in a very specific look for that. Let's see. Oh, I'm way behind on this chat. Let me see if I can catch up here. Well, we're going slightly over. And DTNL, you're making me want to try night photography. I don't have friends to try it out though. The Sonys aren't bad. Sonys aren't bad, but they definitely cap your night photography at quality settings well before what other phones will do. Right now, undisputed, easily, the night photography champ is Vivo. The V1 processor, co-processor on the X70 is mind-bogglingly fast. Like you're holding still for like a 2 second exposure and you'll beat Pixel 6s, you'll beat iPhones, you'll crush Samsungs. I mean, if you want that computational stacked DNG, multiple image, low light photo, Vivo, all day, every day. Sony expects that you know what you're doing with a camera. And if you're in a low light situation, a professional would use a flash or a tripod or a stabilizer, would use longer shutter speeds, would use sort of ISO up to a point, but then would would prevent the photo from getting too grainy or too pixelated or too sort of smeary. So Sony doesn't just go to a computational extreme. They expect that you're going to use good photography habits to get that better low-light photo. People think that that's wrong because smartphones should just hold your hand and do all of this AI processing for you. I understand where Sony's coming from, but it would be nice if they could kind of find a middle ground. I wouldn't mind just slightly more aggressive processing on their low-light mode. They do have a night mode, and it's not bad, but it certainly doesn't impress like a Pixel 6 night sight or an iPhone night mode or a Vivo can literally turn night into day. Like, I've been in almost blackout conditions on a Vivo, and suddenly here's this super bright, vivid image with crystal sharp pinpoints of starlight, and the colors are correct for the data that it's filling in on, like, trees and houses and windows, and it's magic. It really is. I know people are like, oh, but that's so unrealistic because the scene was really dark and I want things to be accurate. And like, BS. You don't care about that. If you cared about that, then you would fuse, you know, like a 30 millimeter lens to this camera and only operate it within the, you know, sort of ISO capabilities of the human eye. Like, just the fact that we have lenses that can zoom in things, we're already not concerned about pure accuracy in some kind of philosophically objective sense. Oh, DT is, I'm convincing him to flip his Xperia 5. Stick with your Xperia 5. It's a great phone. I'm not telling you to like, you know, get rid of something that's working for you. Oh yeah, Kappa Cash. Taking some pics of the eclipse last night with my Pixel 6 made me wish for that periscope lens like on the Sony. The Pixel 6 Pro periscope is kind of great. It's really good. It's also one that, you know, again, folding that lens and giving you a longer focal length on a larger sensor's pretty sweet. I know a lot of people said, you know, Pixel 6 Pro isn't worth the additional cost, but that's genuinely the best telephoto for indoor shooting I've ever used on a phone. And the Xperia is good, but if I'm trying to capture indoor candids in sort of like room lighting, you know, really soft, cozy indoor home lighting, Pixel 6 Pro is formidable. It's pretty crazy. Oh, Dave Burns, good point. You can currently get the Xperia 5 Mark III for $669.95 on B&H right now. That's crazy pants. 5 Mark III is a really solid phone. Oh, Barry Johnson, yep, my favorite phone of the year so far is that iQOO 9 Pro. I mean, I'm keeping it safe for you. I'm going to keep, you know, just using this phone, playing with it. I'll make sure nothing happens to this phone. Barry, you know it's in good hands with me. That was evil. I'm sorry, man. Aditya Nail saying some great things about the Xiaomi Mi 12 seems to be nailing the nighttime shots. I mean, again, I'm not saying Xiaomi isn't putting out good products. What I'm sort of surprised by is we saw sort of a spread of premium tier on the Mi 11s. Mi 11i, Mi 11, Mi 11, was there like a Pro or a Plus, and then a Mi 11 Ultra. And I'm just kind of surprised that we haven't seen the same push for Xiaomi 12. It's not seeing the same kind of spread of kind of overlapping at the sort of flagship killer space and then offering like a crazy balls to the wall, like top tier, best of everything that we've got. And that's why I'm kind of surprised. Like, I expected Xiaomi... Like, Xiaomi's been killing it with Pocos and Redmis. I kind of expected the name brand Xiaomi, to also kind of hit that top tier, which hasn't really happened. All right. Dave Burns, an SGGQA podcast running long? Well, I never. I love it. uh, All right. Let me. I think I've finally caught up here. Yeah, Pro and also an Ultra. Yeah. Barry Johnson also saying, I'm not sure why the Xiaomi 12 Ultra isn't out yet. I think a lot of companies are kind of slow playing it right now. Consumers are not shopping Android at the most expensive tiers. Like, we are not inspiring consumers to really look at what those top tier iPhone expensive Androids have to offer. And I think this is definitely kind of a constricting year. Like, we know smartphone sales are kind of peaking and plateauing. We know a number of companies are struggling to kind of keep up with some of their forecasting and some of their sales projections. And I think right now it's just too expensive to put together a phone with the best of the best of the best and charge a price for it that consumers won't totally flip out. I'm holding an Xperia 1 Mark IV. This is the highest resolution OLED on any mobile consumer electronics device. You know, this is 3840 pixels tall. It is the clearest, the sharpest screen on the market today, 120 hertz refresh, and this year actually approaches outdoor viewability better than any Sony I've seen since like the original Z line and XZ lines of phones can. It's got a 5,000 milliamp hour battery in a frame that's definitely competitive skinny against some of the slimmest phones out there. It has a headphone jack, has 512 gigabytes of storage, but also has a user removable SIM card SD card tray that you don't need a pin tool for. It's got the most advanced power management features on a mainstream phone, only competing are gaming phones for things like charge separation and battery health. It's got 4K 120 frame per second readout on all three rear sensors. It's got an upgraded selfie shooter that is an improvement over the One Mark II and One Mark III. This thing is an absolute monster specs-wise. And the 512 gig version of this phone is going to cost $1,600 in the United States. That's a little bit more expensive than a 512 gig iPhone. But this thing can genuinely do things no other phone can do. This phone genuinely has hardware on it that no other phone has. And this phone genuinely has battery health and longevity support that only gaming phones are trying to replicate. This is one of the premium options for content creation. It's one of the best options you can shop for gaming. And if you're into multimedia playback at all, you've got one of the best screens and the ability to go wired or wireless with your audio. There really is no corner cutting here. And to get that, that means you got to pay full retail. So I can see where Xiaomi is looking at what this phone is going through or what the rest of the market is going through and saying, if we put together a Xiaomi 12 Ultra and we put all of this top tier hardware into it, how much are we going to need to charge to eke out a modest profit? And that's going to be a $1,600 plus phone. I just don't see where you can keep pushing the envelope and not raise prices in this current economy. I feel like this should be pretty clear. Unless they want the phone to fail and sell it at a loss, no company wants to do that right now. No company wants to subsidize their ultra premium tier phone, make it cheaper in the minds of consumers so that they'll never spend the big money to get that phone. The Samsung strategy is a failure. The Samsung strategy in the South Korean kind of psychology already tanked LG. We don't get LG phones anymore because of how LG operated their smartphone division. And they kept playing with the psychology of the value of their products. We don't want that to happen. So every time you see Samsung at launch and everyone's going crazy for pre-orders and all these crazy great trade-in deals, and then there's a massive price cut literally weeks after that phone launches, that's bad for the premium Android market. It just makes it look like the only premium expensive phone worth buying is a iPhone because it never falls in price and it just works and it's got the value. That's not the game we should be playing. Sony has the right strategy, but you got to pay for it. And that's a bummer. The Xperia division, selling like hotcakes. Xperia 1 Mark III never made it back into my hands because the Sony PR team literally couldn't get an acquisition request in for retail boxed units for a channel my size. The phones kept selling out before they would give their own PR team more phones for reviewers like me. That's the right play. That phone was kinda review-proof, sold like crazy in Japan and China, did very well in the few other regions throughout the EU that it was sold, and sold reasonably well here in the United States too. By the time it made it to the United States, they had fulfilled all of the other international demand. That's what we need to see more of. That's what real phone growth looks like. But in a climate where every single component is getting more expensive to manufacture, getting more expensive to ship and distribute, we're going to have to expect these phone prices to climb. Every single time you see a phone launch, it's a $1,200 phone. Oh, but no, just kidding. We'll sell it to you for $800. Oh, and a trade-in, we'll cut the price in half. Oh, and we'll also do a coupon sale for people on points that have reward loyalty programs. That phone failed. That phone didn't make the company a profit. Samsung can eat those failures because they're making way more money on Galaxy A series. Sony can't eat those failures, so they're only going to make phones that they can make a profit off of. And that's the game. If you want the features, if you think what's cool about an Xperia would be fun to play with, that's what that tech costs. And that's the game that they're going to play. And that's what you have to do to get in on it. You're talking to someone who bought two Surface Duos at full MSRP. I know the pain of extending that wallet to try and, you know, keep up with current tech. It doesn't always feel good, but I've genuinely enjoyed my time with these devices, and I feel I'm getting my money's worth out of them. So, I think we can go ahead and wrap this all up. I've been rambling on long enough. I'm scrambling to just finish up a couple other little clips, shooting some extra B-roll on the Xperia. I have a little bit more to say, but I'm being very cautious. I'm being very conservative on how I'm talking about the Xperia, just because mine is a prototype. I feel it is grossly irresponsible to talk about the embargo week launch of any phone, but we also know that this is a phone that's months away from actual retail distribution. That's always been Sony's game. We know this won't really be going out internationally until sort of June-ish. And then by the time it makes it to the United States, it's probably going to be on its second major software update. And that's what the reality of using that phone will look like. It's not what you can talk about today. It's how the phone is managed over July and August. So I'm very encouraged because I feel like that's always been a good play for the United States. We've gotten really good products out of Sony on that timetable. And you know it's going to be around September. They're not late. They're just letting you know early when the phone's going to arrive. So let me get this out of the way here. And Aditya is saying, thank you, Juan, for a chat and an epic show. This was awesome. Please stay safe and hydrated. Have an amazing week ahead. Dave Burns, I am shocked that Juan is rambling. So, yeah, it's fun stuff. I've got some fun things coming up. I wish I could say more. I'm going to have a couple follow-ups to some videos. There's going to be, I think, another video coming out for Slick Deals. Some really, really, really cool things. So be on the lookout for some conversations. This is the part where I also want to shout out the other streamers that are going to be going up this week. Tech for Your Needs, Lulu. He's going to be streaming, I think, this afternoon or this evening. Tomorrow is Kimmy, Gadget Goddess. That's always a really great show. Wednesday, Easy Computer Solutions with Eric. Thursday is Ike's Tech Talk. Someone let me know. I've really not been keeping track if Tech King Mike has been back up and streaming or not. But I'm pretty sure Ike is going to be streaming again. Then on Thursday, it's TK and I for Best of Our Week. We do a sort of a later night stream just because we're West Coast. Friday is LaShawn, Holla at Your Boy. Last week's stream with LaShawn was pretty hilarious. Saturday is TK Bay, Saturday Morning with a Side of Tech on the Android Bay, the Android Bay. And then Sunday should be Jeff, El Jefe Reviews, doing his Sunday stream. Literally every day, you've got awesome content. Oh, Barry says Mike is coming back in a couple of weeks. So I don't think Mike is going to be streaming this week. Hopefully not next week, but the week following, we should see Tech King Mike back on Thursdays for Mike and Ike. So that should be pretty cool too. So, yes, we've got awesome stuff to talk about, awesome stuff to play with. I mean, we didn't even talk about Google I.O. I mean, maybe I need to do a second side stream just to break down like the recap and the reflections on Google I.O. Maybe I'll do that on the Patreon. We'll do a Google I.O. stream a week later for the Patreon. Everybody, I need you all to have a fantastic week. This week, this podcast always starts me off on the right note. I love getting to have these conversations with y'all. I love being able to jump in, mix it up with the comments, these questions. Lots of really heavy news stories out there. There's a lot of scary stuff happening every day, and our news cycle is so ratcheted. It can be hard to like keep up with it all, but then also just sort of figure out how we feel about the things that are happening out there. And so I always end these with the call to action of being the good tech neighbor. I'm always encouraged by the people that I see in this chat that I know. These are people that are largely examples of being good tech neighbors, good resources for your family and friends, trying to share good information and participate. But this week, I really want to lean a little heavily just on the mental health aspect. I'm pretty close to burnout. I've been working really hard. I'm recognizing in myself that I'm hitting limits, and my limits are a little bit lower than they used to be when I was younger. And the realization of that comes with a psychological toll. And so for everyone out there, respect your limits, respect your mental health, treat yourselves well, don't talk poorly about yourselves, don't make fun of yourselves, be good to yourselves. Because I feel like that's the only way we're going to be able to keep up. We can't be good tech neighbors if we aren't good to ourselves. So that's my wish for you over this next week, with all of the craziness and the highs and the lows, the really fun and amazing things that are happening and the really dark and scary things that are happening. Give yourself that buffer, give yourself that time, and give yourself the well wishes that you deserve. Speak kindly of yourself and be kind to yourself so you can be kind to others. So with that, I'm going to say have an amazing week. Do awesome with your technology. Be awesome with your technology. I'll catch you back here for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I love y'all. Take care.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.